Okay. Zephaniah tonight, chapter 3. Just by way of a quick review of where we've been in Zephaniah. Zephaniah, remember, is prophesying during the days of Josiah. So you're at the time that he is writing this, you are probably about 40 to 50 years out from the beginning of the Babylonian captivity. I think we put our, I'm just trying to go back here, we put our time probably somewhere around, maybe 622. And the Babylonian captivity starts in 605, so that's going to be about 17 years. There's three deportations to Babylon. The last one is in 586. And so it's in this span. So that's how far they were from the final deportation of Babylon. And this is a prophecy of what's going to happen to the people of Judah. We've looked at some minor prophets that are speaking to Israel, and Israel and Judah. This one is just to Judah now. It's late. And we know that because of where it's, because the time, the reign in which it is in. It's against the people of the city of Jerusalem in particular, the center of Judaism in the south. But interwoven with the coming judgment of Babylon against Judah, by using Babylon against Judah, God also has interwoven in here, we saw in the end of chapter 1, also prophecies of the day of the Lord. So we have prophecies of near judgment and distant judgment. Both of those, by the way, are day of the Lord. Because day of the Lord is any time that God enters in and functions as judge. We even have, that is classified in that way. You have day of God, in which God is going to act in that regard in the future, and the heavens and earth are going to be destroyed during the day of the Lord. But when you and I stand before the Lord Jesus Christ in the day of Christ, the day of our Lord Jesus Christ, it's when our works are judged. So we've already kind of looked at this. But for the most...
Anytime they say day, it's the judgment.
Well, you have to always look at it in context, because you have something where you have day use that it's obviously not. But day frequently is looking at a period of time in which there's something that is either an individual or a principle that is governing something in some way, determining what's acceptable or not acceptable. And so when Jesus Christ, he talks about his hour, but it's also about it's not the day. And so we have both those scenarios in which he's going to come. But he entered into the day of man, in which man's judgment. So we talked about that. That right now we're living in the day of man. That's going to go on up until the day of the Lord breaks that off. So right now we stand under man's judgment. That's one of the reasons this is the present evil age. And it's one of the reasons, not only that it's the present evil age, but it's also one of the reasons that we... that the world system operates with such propensity, such a strength. I was going to say, we have a propensity to be governed by it, and I think that has to do with the way the world system operates in this day of man, which is another... We only have one reference to that, but it's pretty clear what's going on. But we have this day of the Lord, this time of future judgment. And then that brought us into chapter 2, in which he goes through and point by point goes through the nations that have caused problems. The Philistine nations we saw in verse 4, we looked at Moab and Ammon. So the Philistine nations are to the west, Ammon and Moab are off to the east. And I actually just listened to a lecture the other day that is interesting, because remember one of the things he said about Sodom and Gomorrah, and we just talked about this last week, not Sodom and Gomorrah, it involves them, but it talks about Moab and Ammon. Look in verse 9, it says, therefore, this is chapter 2, verse 9 of Zephaniah, therefore, as I live, declares the Lord of hosts, the God of Israel, surely Moab will be like Sodom, and the sons of Ammon like Gomorrah. And you know why that is significant? We talked about this last week, because they're in the area where Sodom and Gomorrah is at. But traditionally, people have looked at Sodom as probably being on the southern tip of the Dead Sea. In reality, Sodom was out to the east of that area. It's east of the Jordan. The Jordan flows into it. And the reason we know that it's east of the Jordan is because it tells you in Genesis. When Lot and Abraham went separate ways. Remember, their shepherds are getting into conflicts because their flocks are too many. What are we going to do about this? And Abraham, nice guy that he is, says, you choose, Lot, and you go whatever way you go, we'll go the other way. And and Lot lifted up his eyes and looked to the east and saw that the plains were well watered and thought, I'm going to pick the well-watered, green, lush pastures for my flocks. And so it said he went east across the Jordan and went over there and went as far and set up his tents over there in that area as far as Sodom. So Sodom was actually out in that east country that isn't not lush today, but it's not lush because of God's judgment. So keep that in mind. And this person was, anyway, this man that I was listening to do this lecture was referencing a professor from a seminary down in, Arizona or New Mexico, who has doing research on this. And they're saying, we've been looking for Sodom in the wrong place for years because we're always looking at the Dead Sea, and it's not the Dead Sea. It tells you right where it's at in Genesis. It says it's east of the Jordan. It's where it was at. In fact, when there was the battle, it had to do with the kings of the east over there where Lot got carried away. Anyway, so that was interesting. Just heard that the other day and listened to this lecture, and I thought, I may have to share that with you. And then he goes and he looks at the nations to the north and south. So Ethiopia to the south, because at the time that this is being written, Ethiopia was exercising dominance or control over much of Egypt at this time. So Egypt is not the dominant nation. And then Nineveh, the capital of Assyria, to the north. And Nineveh, remember, doesn't fall till 612. We already saw that in the last minor prophet. And so that brings us then that as he's looked at the day of the Lord, and then here in chapter 2, looking specifically at God's judgment of these nations that surround Israel, or Judah, comes to chapter 3. And now he's going to issue a warning not just to these other nations, but he's going to talk specifically to Jerusalem. He says, woe to her who is rebellious and defiled. So it's a rebellion and a defiled one. And then the New American Standard says a tyrannical city. And the word tyrannical there is literally a city that is oppressing. When we were looking at our words on wealth and prosperity, one of the words for the poor, the impoverished, was the word oni. Literally those who are pressed down. Well, that's this word here. It's a verb form. It's related to this. Those that press down. And so these are the ones that were doing the pressing down. It said she heeded no voice. She accepted no instruction. She did not trust in the Lord, and she did not draw near to her God. So you have all these times where God, and when he says that, she hasn't done this. It says she has not heeded no voice, accepted no instruction. When would she have received instruction or there would have been a voice that would have been uttering to her?
Probably.
Anytime you had a prophet, and you've had quite a few prophets up to this point. You've got Jeremiah is going to be prophesying really close shortly after the time of Zephaniah. Jeremiah is going to come on the scene. But prior to that, you have Isaiah prophesying. Isaiah, remember, has a long prophetic life. Isaiah prophesies for close to 70 years. It's one of the reasons a lot of people say, oh, that had to be more than one prophet. Couldn't have all been one writer, because nobody would have prophesied that long. Nobody could have lived long enough to be a prophet that long. Well, hey, if Jewel were able-bodied and he were a prophet, he could still be prophesying, 97 years old, you know. Easily could have started at 27 and been prophesying all that time. So there are people that live long lives even today. And some people that live long lives and are able-bodied and able-minded past 100. Some, not many, but some. So you have a lot of prophets that have come to the nation, and they have spoken, and it says they have not, she has not heeded or listened to a voice, she accepted no instruction. And she did not trust in the Lord. So when she's had opportunities, and we've kind of briefly looked at this, remember back in chapter 1, it's actually not a woe in here. I'm getting this mixed up with the next book I've been working on. We have woes. It's where God's promising judgment back in 1:5 to those who bow down on the housetops to the hosts of heaven. They bow down and they swear to the Lord, but they actually swear him by Milcom, by another god, while they're up there. So the point being is, rather than trusting in God, these people were trusting in false gods. Okay? And it says, and she did not draw near to her God. How would you draw near to God? If you were a Jew, go to the temple. I was actually looking at verses the other day where God says, seek me while I may be found. Well, when would he be found? While he was still at the temple. Ezekiel actually, go to the book of Ezekiel, and you're going to find out in the early chapters that Ezekiel's going to get to see a vision of the glory leaving the temple. Then they could go up and seek God at the temple, and he's not there anymore. So when he's speaking to the nation of Israel, he says, seek me while I may be found, because it's not going to be much longer, and I'm going to be gone. And then you won't be able to find me. But they didn't do that. They did not draw near to God. And then it says, her princes within her are roaring lions. Her judges are wolves at evening, and they leave nothing for the morning. Both statements here also reminiscent of the prophecies by Ezekiel, where he looks at the leaders of Israel as shepherds. Shepherds that are supposed to care for the sheep, make sure the sheep are well fed, make sure that the sheep are bandaged and bound up when they're hurt. But all they were doing was killing the sheep and eating them and enjoying the milk of the sheep, but were doing nothing to care for them. And this is kind of the same picture you have here. They're just the people that are supposed to be their leaders, their official political leaders, as well as her judges in this regard. While they're supposed to be looking out for the people, what are they doing? They're taking advantage of the people, and they're like wolves. And when it says her judges are wolves at evening, does anybody know anything characteristic about wolves?
They howl.
They go in packs.
And they move at packs, but why? What's the significance of evening?
That's when they come out to do their hunting?
They tend to be more nocturnal. They tend to be more nocturnal hunters in this. It's kind of like you and I even live around coyotes, and coyotes are not wolves, but coyotes are like that. They pretty much bed down most of the day, and they come out and hunt at night.
That's when their prey comes out.
What?
That's when their prey comes out.
And so the wolves, in this regard, when it talks about the wolves in here, and not that wolves don't hunt during the day, but wolves are more inclined to, we're in verse 3, for judges are wolves at evening. Peg and I watched some video clips on the internet back about a year ago of some people that sent up a camera, a motion camera, over in, I don't know if it's in North Idaho, or, no, it was in Montana. This was in Montana. And they had a carcass out there, and it was watching the wolves, and the wolves would come by at night. That's why they weren't coming by during the day, but they'd come by, and they fed on this for a few nights. They kept coming by. It was a carcass, I think it was a carcass of a horse that they were visiting. But there were other horses in the pasture that would come over and stand by this for a while until the wolves would come by. So anyway, I get sidetracked, sorry here. But her judges are wolves at evening. Point being is, acting as lions and as wolves, they're feeding themselves. They're going after the very people they should be helping. I mean, could you imagine if you were going for help, and you go to stick your hand out for help, and they bite the hand off? Then it starts thrashing at it, you know? That's the picture that he's giving. And the result is they leave nothing for mourning. So you come by in the morning and there's nothing left. That's the way he says they act. Then he says verse 4. And her prophets now. Now we have the religious individuals in particular. Now keep in mind, the princes and the judges, the way God set up the law, were to be religious. You didn't have a secular government in Judah. It was actually a government that was to be religious. But it didn't end up being that way. They ended up kind of dividing these to some degree. But now we're looking at the prophets here, and it says the prophets are reckless. And reckless, whatever you might think of it, the idea of it is literally to run with speed, but careless run. So it's just like, you ever watch the little kid that's starting to figure out how to walk, and then they take off running, and you kind of see they put the head down going, and you're just thinking it's just a matter of time before, boom, they're going to do a head plant. They're just going to go right forward. They haven't got that down. Well, that's this word that's being used here for the prophets, the way they do this. They're also treacherous men. And the word treacherous is a word that involves deceit. I think probably most of us understand when you think of treachery, you think of somebody that's deceiving. So he says the prophets are treacherous. They deceive people, but they deceive people with their own agenda in mind. So they're deceiving people to try to achieve their agenda. Her priests have profaned the sanctuary. What does profane mean? You think of profane, what do you...
Polluted?
Polluted. Remember, God under the law made Israel different by giving them lots of laws to just make them different from the other peoples. We've talked about that. That's one of the reasons that they couldn't eat pork. It's not that pork was in and of itself an unclean meat. It was because by giving them this, God was making a difference between them and these other nations. It's very important that he was doing this.
So basically he's saying the priests were unbelievers.
Well, or at least they weren't acting faithful when they were doing this, because it's possible maybe even for a believer to act in an unfaithful manner. But when it says the priests have profaned the sanctuary, remember, there were all kinds of qualifications that the priests had to meet, or anybody, even you as an average, if you were a Jew to come to the temple, there were qualifications that you had to meet, things that you couldn't do. You know, you couldn't, if you were unclean because of an unclean thing that you happened to touch. Couldn't go to temple until you had gone through the process of being cleaned. You could, maybe you touched a dead body or something like that.
So these priests that have profaned the sanctuary, wouldn't they have been killed if they didn't do something just right and they defiled it or whatever?
Okay. You're thinking of them going into the Holy of Holies, which is where they were before the ark. Remember, there was only one man that went into the Holy of Holies, and he did it twice on one day out of the year. So the rest of the time, these people are coming in, and there's an incense burner in front of that curtain. And that's where most of these priests went, and they would offer incense up on this thing before the ark that's on the other side of this curtain.
Okay, so they could go on into that part even if they weren't just right and not die.
Right. And God did kill people, because you've got Aaron's two sons that went in and offered strange fire. And by strange fire, we take that to mean an incense that God had not asked for, and most likely then an incense that was tied to another god. Okay, and they offered that, and God took them out for that. Well, these people going and profaning then the sanctuary are profaning it by not observing the law regulations on the cleanness, on the way things were supposed to be offered, the incense were supposed to be burned, but also by, and we know this from Ezekiel, by going up and actually offering prayers to other deities while they were in the temple. And you have that in Ezekiel. You have this vision that Ezekiel sees where he gets to see all these people. You see the women up the front, and the women are actually praying to a goddess. They're not praying to Jehovah. And you see the elders, they're actually down, and he sees all these horrible, unclean things that they're bowing down to in this chamber below. Now, that doesn't mean that there was literally that chamber. Maybe there was, but what he sees, like, there's a thing, and he goes in and looks through these rocks and sees all these men going down and praying to this. This is what's going on. And so he's prophesying against them for this. And lastly he says, and they have then done violence to the law. You all know the word violence. You know this. Because if you ever watch the news or listen to the news, in Israel you have a group over there called Hamas. And that's what the word violence is. It's the word Hamas. Okay. And, that's what this is. They have done violence then to the law. Now, they've done violence to the law by ignoring everything that God laid down in the law for how they were supposed to approach him. And what they were to do, what they weren't to do. As well as the fact that they weren't supposed to be worshiping any other gods. That was, remember that when we talk about the Ten Commandments, those were the first commands. The first commands weren't don't steal and don't bear false witness. The first commands were you don't have any other god before me and you don't make any images of me. You don't bow down to any of these other guys. These are the first commands. And this is exactly what they're doing, is they're just systematically here doing violence to the law by not observing what God had told them that they were supposed to do. Verse 5. In contrast to them, in contrast to the people of the rebellious city, it says the Lord is righteous within her. So at this time, God has not left. Okay? God hasn't actually left the temple. He is about to leave, where he's on the verge of this, as we're going to, as you'd see over in Ezekiel. So the Lord is righteous within her, and he will do no injustice. And that word injustice is a word literally meaning to be dishonest or be crooked by being dishonest is the idea. So it's not just a crooked or wrong thing. It's doing so in a dishonest fashion. So apparently you're giving the impression that you're doing the right thing when in reality you're not doing the right thing, which is really the character of the men up above. I'm sure you all would have told, oh, they're all doing the right thing. But in reality, they weren't. I'm just going to chase down a rabbit trail, but we won't do that. So, and then he goes, and every morning he brings his justice to light. And the word justice that's translated here is a word literally meaning judgment. Sometimes the word justice translates this word mishpat, shafat. Shafat means to judge. Mishpat is judgment. Sometimes it translates zedek. Zedek is the word righteous. This isn't righteous. This is judgment. Now, judgments are what God laid out in the law, where God said, if you do this thing, this wrong thing here, this is the punishment. You do this wrong thing, this is the punishment. We have this form of justice, or when you drive down the interstate and you see a sign saying, click it or ticket. You know, that's in other words, they're telling you, that's the punishment. If you don't have your seatbelt on, this is going to be the fine. And they'll tell you this. And you drive, when Peg and I drove through states, it's amazing the different signs that you see up for seatbelt laws and other laws that say automatic fine of this if you're pulled over, like that. And remember, we have a primary offense right now. It's called talking on your cell phone while driving. And, oh, I tell you, I still can't tell you how many people I watch drive around Oil City and out on the highways. Semi-drivers. I watched a semi-driver 2 weeks ago. I was telling Peg when we were leaving for Bible study, pulling in at Spud's, and he's looking down, and you can tell as he's turning around the corner that he's texting or something. He's looking down, he's got this thing here, and he's going like this, and I'm thinking, oh, man, he's driving that huge machine. But that's a primary offense. A primary offense meaning if an officer observes it, they can pull you over. And then there's a ticket with that. That's a judgment. And that's what he says, is every morning he brings his justice to light. And the reason he says in the morning he brings it to light, he's contrasting it in the back to the wolves that were operating at night, taking advantage of people at night. Really almost like a parallel to what you have in John, where it says that God is light, but men are the world. Men operate in darkness, and they don't like the light because their deeds are evil. So they operate at night to hide the evilness of what they're doing. Okay, and you have this, but there's a little bit more to it than that. It's that in reality, morning time was when the judges were normally, the judges started bringing in, people were brought into judges to consider matters, and they did it in the morning. If you remember what happened with Jesus Christ, when he was put on trial, his first trial, or actually a couple of them during the night, are both illegal because they were not under law supposed to conduct any judgment, any verdicts at night, implying here that the judges were doing this at night, but they weren't supposed to be. In the evening, they're carrying this out, and they're not supposed to be doing that, okay, because they leave nothing over for the morning. But they had to bring Jesus in the morning and have an official trial in the morning where they call the rest of the council together and then take him to Pilate, because they knew legally, according to their law, they weren't supposed to conduct justice at night. They were supposed to do it in the morning. And so God's saying right here, I don't twist any rules to get anything done. I don't work at night. Well, you understand, in terms of bringing about justice. And so this is what God's saying. I don't act like these guys. Morning comes, I'm going to take care of justice, and I'm going to mete it out. It says, he does not fail, but the unjust knows no shame. And that unjust is the same word that we had back in the middle part of verse 5 where it says he will do no injustice. This is just another form of that, talking about the people that act like that, that act in a crooked, dishonest fashion. They're not ashamed of what they do. They're not ashamed. They go back and do it again. They just don't like getting caught. Okay. Verse 6, I have cut off nations. Second, I need to catch up where I'm at in my notes here. We're getting down here. I have cut off nations. Their corner towers are in ruins. I have made their streets desolate with no one passing by. Their cities are laid waste without a man, without an inhabitant. Pretty plain. It's just pretty much laid waste to cities. I said, surely you will revere me, accept instruction. Because remember, they weren't accepting instruction up in verse 2. So her dwelling will not be cut off to all that I have appointed concerning her. In other words, I'm giving you a warning. Don't go down this path. But of course, and if you listen to the warning, these judgments won't come upon you. This dwelling would remain. But they were eager to corrupt all their deeds when he'd given them these warnings in the past. This is the way they'd acted. Therefore, wait for me, declares the Lord. Now, beginning in verse 8, he's going to look at those people that can actually have, that can actually listen to the prophecy and realize what's actually going to come. And so the first one, he says, therefore, wait for me. He's looking at this idea of expecting the Lord to actually come and do something. Let me show you. Let's see, which one did I want to look at here? Isaiah 64, there it is. When you write down too many verses, you have to kind of go back through and figure out which one's which. I'm sorry, that's not the right one. Maybe I've got it written down over here. Just a second. Well, I looked at it again today, and then I didn't write it down here with my extra notes. Okay. Well, anyway, I'm sorry, because this is not the right one.
What are we looking for?
Well, we're looking for. I was just going to make reference to the passage in which God tells them those that wait for the Lord will mount up with wings like eagles. Maybe 55. Because 53 is the suffering Savior. I know it is, and I just went over it again today, and I'm just totally drawing a blank on it here. And it's right towards the end of the chapter too.
Isaiah 40:31.
40:31. Thank you, Jim. This is a chapter that's looking forward to the Babylonian captivity at the beginning of this. And then, it's talking about, like in verse 2, speak kindly to Jerusalem, call out to her that her warfare is ended. In other words, because of what's happened, the warfare is done. Then in verse 3, it says, a voice is calling, clear the way for the Lord in the wilderness, make smooth in the desert a highway for our God. That's talking about the Lord's first coming. This is what John the Baptist did. He was making a way ready for him to come. And so that's what the first part of this is all about. And then we go on down in the context, and it talks about what he's going to, ultimately what he's going to do. And I'm just going to kind of jump down here, because there's a lot of stuff, and I don't want to get too bogged down in there. Go to verse 27, and we'll read here. It says, why do you say, O Jacob, and assert, O Israel, my way is hidden from the Lord, and the justice due me escapes the notice of my God? Do you not know? Have you not heard?
That judgment again? Justice due me, or that judgment? That same word?
I have an English Bible, sorry. I can't see. I don't have my Hebrew with me. I'm sorry. Due me escapes the notice of my God. Do you not know, have you not heard, the everlasting God, the Lord, the creator of the ends of the earth, does not become weary or tired. His understanding is inscrutable. Wonderful statement, is it? God doesn't. In other words, you never wear God out. I've watched, we had friends that put on Facebook the other night, they're 2 years older than us. They're both 49, and they got married the weekend after we got married. And she put on there, and she says, there's a reason, she says, you don't have two-year-olds when you're 49. She says, it's taken two of us to keep up with one two-year-old. She says, we're just exhausted. They're taking care of their grandson. And she said, we just can't hardly, you know. And I watched kids, even, you know, when you're able-bodied, wear you out so that pretty soon kids still going strong and mom and dad are like, you know. God doesn't do that. God doesn't ever wear out. You don't wear them out until eventually gives up. I've seen that happen to teachers in school, that the kids just wear the teacher down, and because the teacher doesn't have the smarts to be able to know how to nip it in the bud, the kids eventually wear the teacher down. Pretty soon the teacher doesn't care. And it's just a free-for-all. It's crazy. See, God doesn't do that. And that's what he's saying, is when God, these people keep thinking, you know, God doesn't see, and we keep getting away with it, and we wear, he says, you don't wear God down. Because God does not become weary and tired. His understanding is inscrutable. You don't hide anything from him. He gives strength to the weary. To him who lacks might, he increases power. Though youths grow weary and tired, and vigorous young men stumble badly, yet those who wait for the Lord. Now this is talking about waiting for his advent. And I believe that this is both for those people that were really looking for and anticipating his first advent that he was talking about in verse 3, and it also will be true for those who are anticipating his second advent out in the tribulation. So it's true in both cases. Those that are waiting for him, they're expecting him to come. They will gain new strength, and they will mount up with wings like eagles. They will run and not get tired. They will walk and not become weary. And it's kind of interesting when he uses that expression, mount up with wings like eagles. You have that at the end of Revelation 12 when it says that when Satan comes down and goes after the nation of Israel, it says it was given to her wings to escape. She flies off into a place God prepares for her. That's figurative of God granting her supernatural ability to flee and get away. But what he's saying here for these people that were looking, and think of two of the people that were waiting for the birth of Jesus were old people. Zacharias and Anna. They're older people. Yeah, and then, I'm not saying that. I didn't say it. First, was Simeon and Anna. And then Zacharias and Elizabeth, John the Baptist's parents. Yeah. These are the people. But they're all older people that are waiting for this, and they're being given strength as they're. They're not youths, but God's giving them supernatural strength as they're looking forward to the future. Now, the reason I come over here is because it's those that are wait for the Lord. Popular passage. I went through a number of these. I just was going to come over this because this is one that's so popular. I've heard people preach on this, that waiting on the Lord is praying for him. That's not what he's talking about. He's actually talking about people that are waiting. They're expecting God to act in a certain matter. So now if we go on back over to Zephaniah very quickly, keep this in mind. This is the same thing now that we have over here in verse 8. He says, therefore, wait for me. So he's telling these people, wait for me. It says, for the day when I rise up to pray, indeed, and pray, P-R-E-Y, so animal pray. Indeed, my decision is to gather nations, to assemble kingdoms, to pour out on them my indignation, all my burning anger, for all the earth will be devoured by the fire of my zeal. Now, having said that, keep your finger here, flip over to Revelation. Turn to chapter 16. Revelation chapter 16, look with me at verse 13. It says, and I saw then coming out of the mouth of the dragon, and out of the mouth of the beast, and out of the mouth of the false prophet, three unclean spirits like frogs. For they are spirits of demons performing signs which go out to the kings of the whole world to gather them together for the war of the great day of God the Almighty. He's gathering all these nations together. Flip over to chapter 19 here in Revelation. We have in the first part of this, we have the Lord Jesus Christ coming out of heaven in verse 11 down through verse 16, and then if you go on down to to verse 19, it says, "And I saw the beast and the kings of the earth and their armies assembled to make war against him who sat upon the throne and against his army." And then it's, we have the season of the beast and the false prophet. And then in verse 21, it says, "And the rest were killed with the sword, which came from the mouth of him who sat upon the horse, and all the birds were filled with their flesh." In other words, this, if you flip back now over to Zephaniah chapter 3, this verse 8, talking about the day, the time of his decision to gather the nations, to assemble the kingdoms, to pour out my, and we have two expressions here, my indignation and my burning anger, which is what the tribulation or Daniel's 7th week is. It's a time of his wrath. It's a time where he pours out his anger and his wrath. In fact, I was going over one of the passages where it talks about the fact that he's going to make them drink of the cup of his wrath, undiluted. So it's full strength wine, not watered down with water. Full strength, you're going to get my wrath, not diluted down with a little kindness.
So this couldn't be referring to, it's either what, Matthew 23 or 24, where he sends the angels out to gather, to snatch people out for the sheep and goat judgment, because by the time you have the sheep and goat judgment, his wrath is already poured out.
Yeah, that's
another gathering, but it's a different gathering.
That's a gathering that's at the end of this. This is the gathering of these nations to come for him to make war with, for him to pour out his wrath on them, and he's going to bring them together. So in verse 8, he's referring to the second advent or the second coming. He's referring to what we call or what we see in Revelation 19. Okay, so everybody see that? That's what he's talking about. And that's why he says, "Therefore, wait for me." So just like we just looked at over there in Isaiah, we had them waiting for him, people waiting for him in the first advent. This is not looking for him coming in the first advent here, because this is waiting for him when he comes to take prey. When Jesus came in the first advent, did he come to take prey? Did he come to assemble the nations and pour out judgment? In fact, no, he said, "I didn't come for judgment." He tells that in John 3.
So in the NASB it says, "For when I rise up as a witness." So is that just because pray sounds a lot different than witness? Am I looking at the wrong verse?
Okay, you're verse 8.
Yeah, okay, yeah. "For the day when I rise up as a witness, indeed my decision is to gather nations, to assemble kingdoms."
I've got old New American Standard. You've got new American Standard, okay. And they've changed the word.
So pray is probably a better word. Yeah.
Let me check my, yeah, I have pray down in my, when I did my translation on here. Okay. Yeah.
Verse 8.
It's the second line in there. "For the day when I rise up to the prey." And yours has witness, because you've got the new version of it.
"When I rise up as prey?"
To the prey.
P-R-E-Y.
To the prey. Okay.
Yeah.
And it's because he's going to... They're going to be like devoured, or he's going to.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think they're taking it. They're looking at. It's literally. It's for the av, and they're looking. They're taking the av back to a word for a witness or a testimony, rather than taking it for the term pray here. So it's the way they're. But I think pray fits the context better, because he's talking about what he's going to do to these people, and actually at the end of it. What does he say? The second to the last line in verse 8, "For all the earth will be devoured by the fire of my zeal." Okay. And what does he do? He pours out with a sword that comes out of his mouth that causes, according to Zechariah, causes the flesh to fall off the bones of everybody that stands there to make war with him. Verse 9. Now, beginning with verse 9, from here on down. So verse 8 is talking about waiting for the second advent. So you're talking about waiting for him to come back at the end of Daniel's 70th week. So he's jumping forward again. Verse 9 then goes right beyond that, now out to the millennial kingdom. And notice what he says. "For then I will give to the peoples purified lips." And this word purified, I had to look this word up, because this was not a normal word you see for clean. It's a word, here I wrote it down. It's a form of this word, or the base of this word is potash, lye, or alkali, which were all used for cleaning or scrubbing
wash your mouth out with soap.
It's talking about soap. But potash, lye, and alkali were all used, they were used for refining metals, and actually this word is actually meant to polish metal. So if you have a metal, it's not what you use for refining, it's what you'd use to polish it. My wife could share you wonderful stories of growing up when they'd have company and her mom would get the silver out, and the girls would have to spend an afternoon at the table polishing the silver because it sits in the box and it tarnishes, you know. So you got to polish that all before you can serve it. Well, that's what he's talking about here. He's going to polish, clean up the lips, scrub them down, wash out the mouth with soap, that all of them may call on the name of the Lord. What does that contrast to that we've looked at in Zephaniah?
They were calling out, they were worshiping idols.
They were worshiping idols. They were on top of the rooftops, bowing down to the host of heaven. They were swearing by Jehovah while at the same time swearing by Milcom. But now he's going to clean them so that all their mouths, everybody's mouths are cleaned, and they're all going to call out just the name of the Lord. To serve him shoulder to shoulder. So in other words, there's not a weak link among them when he looks at this. Everybody gets that when he says shoulder to shoulder. Everyone there is doing their part. Everyone is participating. You don't have a whole back going, yeah, I'll move my lips, but I'm not really going to say anything. I'm not doing this. No, they're all participating. At the beginning of the millennial kingdom, yes, exactly. Because later on, it'll be otherwise. Verse 10. And it says, from beyond the rivers of Ethiopia, because remember he had Ethiopia earlier as one of the judge nations, my worshipers, my dispersed ones, will bring me offerings. See, even the Ethiopians will be engaged in this. Now, some people have used this verse to talk about part of the Jews that were of the diaspora. And those Jews of the diaspora that were in Ethiopia, and I don't know if you remember, but it wasn't, maybe 20 years ago? Wasn't it about 20 years ago you had groups of Jews coming back? You had problems. You had Jews that were leaving Russia, and they were flying back. Russia was allowing Jews to fly back to Israel. But you also had these groups of Jews in Ethiopia that wanted to migrate back to Israel. And that was a question. The Israelis were like, we're sure these guys are Jews. But these guys down here coming from Ethiopia, we're not so sure they're the real deal. So a lot of people ran to this verse and said, see, these are Jews. But this is not talking about that. Whether those people were or weren't Jews coming out of Ethiopia that were migrating back, we don't know. Part of the problem was is those Jews coming back from Ethiopia were dark-skinned individuals. And the Jews didn't think that there was any of them that would have that in their bloodline. But if they'd been down there for a couple thousand years, it's very likely with some interbreeding might have changed. Anyway, that's kind of beside the point here, but this is talking, I believe, plain and simple, about real Gentile people from Ethiopia that are bringing worship up there. Well, we could go there. This tells us in Zechariah 14. We're not going to go there because we're going to be in Zechariah eventually here in our studies. But Zechariah 14 says all the nations are going to come. They're all going to come to the temple. And they're all going to bring offerings. And if they don't, once the kingdom gets rolling out and you start having a little rebellions coming up, those that don't then bring it, they're going to be punished by having no rain on their lands, which means their crops don't grow. He goes on, he says, my worshipers, then my dispersed ones, will bring my offerings. In that day, you will feel no shame because of all your deeds by which you have rebelled against me. For then I will remove from your midst your proud, exalting ones, and you will never again be haughty on my holy mountain. So in other words, the things that you've been involved in the past that you were ashamed of, that you were embarrassed of, he's saying to these people, they're gone. Kind of similar to what he says over in the Psalms, that God would take the sins, as David looked at it, he would remove my sins from me as far as the east is from the west, throws them into the bottom of the sea. For us, they're gone. And he looks at this, they're going to be gone. Remember in Isaiah, towards the end of Isaiah, I think it's in Isaiah 65, it says the former things will not rise up in the heart. Well, if the former things don't rise up in the heart, if you don't remember the fond things, you're not remembering the negative things too. I was just encouraging somebody just, I think it was just yesterday, out of Revelation 21, where it's talking about a real change so that in the future, there are going to be no tears. There's not going to be any pain. There's not going to be sorrow out there. Maybe you guys don't do this. You guys might all be more grown up than me. But I can still, once in a while, I can get myself in a real funk thinking of something really stupid or bad I did 20 years ago. It's like 20 years ago. It's in the past. It's 30 years ago. It's in the past. And I'm sitting there going, man, I wish I could go back and undo that. I don't think there's anything wrong with thinking you wish that hadn't happened. But when you allow it to affect you like that, but he assures them, you got out there, you're not going to be thinking about this rebellion. And he's removed then, he says, he's removed then from your midst the proud and exalting ones. Ezekiel tells us this. Ezekiel tells us that God's going to act like a shepherd. He's going to cause all of them to come as a shepherd, pass under the rod, and he's going to turn out the rebels. And there won't be any left. So that when they come in, it'll only be a pure nation. We should probably go look at that. I did look that one up again today. If I can find it here very quickly. Ezekiel 20. There it is. Ezekiel chapter 20. And the reason he uses this analogy here is because, remember, he was comparing in Ezekiel their leaders to shepherds not doing their job. So he's looking at himself as a shepherd. And he says, in verse 37, "And I shall make you pass under the rod, and I shall bring you into the bond of the covenant, and I shall purge from you the rebels, those who transgress against me. I shall bring them out of the land where they sojourn, but they will not enter the land of Israel. Thus you will know that I am the Lord." Now that's what happens during the tribulation period. You can flip back to Zephaniah. But that's what happens during the tribulation. He brings them back from all the places where they've been scattered. They all come back into the land. But during that time of the tribulation, he purifies out all those who are rebels so that by the time the tribulation is done at the end and he comes back as king, there aren't any but true believers left, so that Isaiah tells us, and Paul repeats in Romans, all Israel will be saved. There won't be any rebels left. And when he's talking about they won't enter the land, he's talking about enter the land in terms of the millennial kingdom. They'll be there in the land in the kind of state that it's in right now, which is, don't compare that. I always say, don't compare that land to what it was like in Joshua's day when they took the land. Don't compare it to what it's going to be like in the millennial kingdom. It's going to be different in both. It's different in both counts. He goes on from there, verse 12 now, Zephaniah 3:12. "But I will leave among you a humble and lowly people, and they will take refuge in the name of the Lord. The remnant of Israel will do no wrong, tell no lies, nor will a deceitful tongue be found in their mouths, for they shall feed and lie down with no one to make them tremble." Again, he's looking at them as sheep that had been mistreated by the lions and wolves of their leaders, and now he's looking at them as sheep, and he's looking at them as a purified people, purified tongue, purified lips. Verse 14, "Shout for joy, O daughter of Zion, O Israel, rejoice and exult with all your heart, O daughter of Jerusalem. The Lord has taken away his judgments against you. He has cleared away your enemies. The King of Israel, the Lord, is in your midst. And you will fear disaster no more." Now, that wasn't true at this time, and it wasn't going to be true. It won't be true until you move on to the millennial kingdom. That Israel is over there, I don't care what you say about those people. I don't know if you saw this in the news last week, but they're practicing disaster drills over there right now because they are worried about Iran building a nuclear weapon. And, of course, what was it? Just yesterday or the day before that Iran actually ran some low-level tests with equipment that they're acquiring for building a nuclear device, or not a nuclear reactor like that. And then they've got people around them that are people to their southwest that are sitting there launching, shooting missiles over at them and things like that. they don't live at peace. They're not in this type of a situation right now. They do fear disaster. They are worried about it. They live in a hostile environment, surrounded by nations that even the ones that they somewhat get along with probably would just assume that they were gone off the map. It would be easier. Verse 16, in that day it will be said to Jerusalem, do not be afraid, O Zion. Do not let your hands fall limp. The Lord your God is in your midst. God, the Lord, is not in their midst today. He is not over there working among them in the way that he will when he reestablishes them in the kingdom. A victorious warrior, he will exult over you with joy. He will be quiet in his love. He talks about, and I've got to take a look at this. Silent in his love, referring to the fact that he's not shouting or he's not calling out to them in the cries that we've had previously in this book, where you've had calls for judgment, call to turn back to him. So it's a very quiet love in the way he comes to them. And he will rejoice over you, though with shouts of joy, distinct from the way that he had shouted at them to turn back, cried out to them through these prophets that they wouldn't listen to. And I will gather those who grieve about the appointed feasts. So they are going to keep feasts. There are going to be feasts that they're going to keep out there during the millennial kingdom. We've looked at those. We saw those in Ezekiel. We've made reference to them in Zechariah. Lost my place. Feast. They came from... verse 18. I will gather those who grieve about the appointed feasts. They came from you, O Zion. The reproach of exile is a burden on them. So those that have grieved over this because the feasts weren't kept, they're not going to be grieving out there. Behold, I am going to deal at that time with all your oppressors. I will save the lame, gather the outcast. I will turn their shame into praise and renown in all the earth. At that time I will bring you in, even at the time when I gather you together. Indeed, I will give you renown or fame and praise among all the peoples of the earth, when I restore your fortunes before your eyes, says the Lord. In other words, the way all these nations have treated them, and the way these people have grieved because even their own people didn't keep the feasts, didn't do these things, they're all dealt with. And the ones that have been mistreated, as he says, the lame, the outcast, all these that were oppressed and pressed down, they actually now, they ascend. They're the ones that are granted this, but not only they within the nation of Israel, but the nation Israel itself is turned around, and it is, we're told over in Deuteronomy, it becomes the head, not the tail. And this is what's happening here at the end. When God brings this in, as he's talking about this remnant of individuals. So Zephaniah starts with a prophecy against the people because of their wickedness, but calls those in there to come out of that. And if they would come out of it, they might be hidden when God brings judgment. They might escape the judgment. God might protect them. And then he goes back and he aims prophecies at the nations around them and promises that they too will be judged because they have caused problems to Israel, both in terms of the way they treated them as well as the way they pushed their religion on the people of Israel. And then finally we come here to chapter 3. And he calls out or he prophesies judgment against the city of Jerusalem and against her leaders and promises them that he as God will come back. And then encourages them, beginning in verse 8, to be people that would wait for him, people that would anticipate his return. And so then you had in the remainder of this chapter what he's doing in setting up the millennial kingdom and the things. And he doesn't give us tons of details on what the millennial kingdom, but what you're finding here is that the people as they go into the millennial kingdom, they themselves aren't going to be corrupt. And people with clean lips, they're all going to be calling on the Lord. They're going to be bringing their offerings from wherever they come from in these different places. And they're going to be, they're no longer going to be rebels. You're not going to have these people that are rebelling against God as you had in the past. Now, what's going to be interesting is our next book that we're going to move into is the book of Habakkuk. And Habakkuk, different than Zephaniah, is going to start off with Habakkuk himself looking at his people and going, God, look at all of this injustice in my nation. When are you going to step in and do something about it? And it's going to talk about the same issue, but unlike Zephaniah, we're going to find out when we go to there, Habakkuk's going to stand there and stand back in awe and say, okay, God, this is what you're going to do. This seems a little extreme. This is a little hard to swallow. You're going to bring Babylon against them, that nation? And you see he's wrestling. He's, I'm going to trust in God, but he's kind of wrestling. But how are you going to do this then? And how are you going to do this? And so both of these, Zephaniah and Habakkuk, they're about the same, though they're written, though we have them in your Bible, Habakkuk and Zephaniah. Habakkuk appears to follow Zephaniah because the situation has grown worse than it was. Because remember, Zephaniah is prophesying under Josiah. The problem is we don't really know with Habakkuk because we don't have time frames specifically given to us. We just know that it's prior to Babylon actually attacking Judah. It's the only thing we know. Okay, any questions? You may not have thought that, but that was a sprint through Zephaniah 3. Just a lot of breath.
Any indication how Israel took Zephaniah's warnings?
They didn't heed them, because as soon as Josiah dies, his sons become evil, and the first son doesn't last very long on the throne. The son after that ends up being one of the sons that's on the throne when Nebuchadnezzar comes down against the city and begins taking them away. So they just become increasingly evil. Jeremiah is the one that, you know, comes and prophesies also to those kings, and the kings don't receive him. In fact, you remember the one time he goes in there, and it says it was wintertime, and the king's sitting, he's got a little, you know, like a heat stove sitting next to his throne there to keep him warm. And they take a penknife, and they're cutting out, they're taking this thing that Jeremiah has written on vellum, you know, animal skin, and cutting those lines by line out, throwing them into the fire. Oh, get rid of it. We don't want to listen to that. Cut that one out. Takes it, throws it in the fire. They read some more. Cut that out. And they cut it with a knife, and they throw it into the fire. See? They won't listen to his prophecy. And then Jeremiah and Baruch have to go back and rewrite all those chapters of Jeremiah all over again.
Was Zephaniah, I mean, I don't know if this is knowable, but was he prophesying during the duration of Josiah's reign?
It says that, yeah. It actually says in verse 1 that it was in the days of Josiah that he was prophesying.
Right. I just didn't know if that meant, like, his prophecy came out during that, what do you say, 30-year, 20-year reign.
Oh, how long Josiah reigned? Yeah, how long?
Well, you had that. You said he was, like, 8 to 30 or something.
You've got better memory than I have to go back. Yeah, he reigns from 640 to 609, so yeah. So that's almost 30, so about 30 years, yeah. And where Zephaniah, how long he prophesied in there? I mean, one of the things is we know when Nineveh falls, this is prophesied, this is written down, at least chapter 2 is written down before the fall of Nineveh, which is 612. So he prophesies sometime before that.
Yeah.
I don't know. And this is, if you're not explaining it to me, I wouldn't quite know, you know, what's going on. I just wonder if they laid down these prophecies that they went, man, I don't know what you're talking about. I mean, they can, like, the early chapter stuff, you know, chapter 3, you know, it's referencing Millennial Kingdom and
I don't know how many of them would have fully understood everything that was going on in chapter 3 at that time. And we know that we know Daniel writes stuff, and Daniel at the end says, when is this? And he says, it's not for you to know, shut up the book. And we know that Peter says they were looking at these things and they were trying to figure out the times, and God the Spirit says, it's not for you, you're prophesying for somebody else to understand this. So he told them to close it up. So I would say with Zephaniah, there are some things within Zephaniah's prophecy.
Yeah. I mean, they can get the gist, like, we're not obeying, you know, and judgment's coming. But yeah, I would think if somebody were to prophesy that, I'd be like, man, I don't get all of it, but okay, I get the warning. Mm-hmm. Anyways.
You know, so the priests profane the sanctuary, that Hophni and Phinehas are what came to mind. I know it's a different time span, but and then actually they went and got the ark, so they had to go into the Holy of Holies, right? And they got the ark and they took it into war against the Philistines, when they were killed, I guess that was God's judgment against them. But I always would have thought that if they went into the Holy of Holies, they would have dropped dead right then and there, you know. But I guess God decided to kill them a little differently. But
well, he was going to punish the nation. He was going to, God actually allowed them to do that so that he could punish the nation by
the ark taken away.
By having the ark taken away, and then they had to go without the ark for a period of time. Yeah. And he also used, and that not only punished them, but it also punished the Philistines.
Yeah, because they're getting all tumors and what, wasn't it?
Tumors, yeah. And overrun by mice. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, yeah, they didn't want the ark anymore, right? I mean,
yeah, no, they wanted to get rid of it.
Yeah, they wanted to get rid of it.
Because they were, because they were.
Yeah. Somebody take this.
Make you take it back. I'll just make it so you don't want it, and you'll make it back.
Yeah.
Have, like,
yeah, that one guy had it in his house. Yeah. And he kept getting blessed. And, oh, you want that back. Yeah. Was it, yeah, then Dave.